All right, we come back to Romans 2, 12 to 15 in this hour. We've seen the first two headings of that passage. And we are going to come, having looked at the facts stated and the objection assumed to the answer elaborated, which is verses 14 and 15. For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness in their thoughts, alternately accusing or else defending them. This is Paul's answer to the objection. How can men sin, let alone perish, without the law? And again, Paul is just amazing in terms of how logical he is, and how, because logical, once you understand what his way of thought is, how easy to understand he is. Because contrary to some people's opinion, logic is easy. Illogic is hard, okay, and difficult to understand. So the initial assertion, and this is the primary assertion of, in fact, the long sentence that composes verses 14 and 15. These to themselves are the law, or they are the law to themselves. These words, because they include the main verb and noun of the sentence, are the primary assertion of the passage. They are the law to themselves. You notice they've put the article in parentheses, but I have put it there because I believe that is the way the passage must be interpreted. I'm going to say a lot about that in this hour. All else in verses 14 and 15 is grammatically secondary to this primary assertion. They are the law to themselves. You have the main verb and noun and direct object here, and, in fact, indirect objects as well. How is it possible, why is it just for Gentiles to sin and perish without the law? Paul's ample answer is simply, and quite clearly, that the Gentiles are the law to themselves. This short statement teaches us several things about the Gentiles' confrontation of themselves with God's law. It teaches us the reality of their confrontation with the law. In this clause, we come to Paul's simplest statement as an answer to the problem raised by the assertion of verse 12a. Gentiles sin. Their sin is imputed. They perish in their sin. All this occurs and only may occur, says Paul, because they are confronted with the law of God. They, in one sense, are without law, but in another sense, they are not. And this is how Paul himself can be consistent in saying no violation without law, no imputation of sin without law, no wrath without law. The only thing that makes Paul consistent with himself is this assertion right here that the Gentiles are for themselves the law. Though not confronted with it as a written revelation, they still are confronted with it. They are the law for themselves. The means of their confrontation with the law is also here. We see the reality of it, the means of it. Paul also reveals the way in which they confront themselves with the law, or the way they are confronted with the law. They are to or for themselves the law, Paul says. The meaning of this is clarified in verses 14 and 15, helpfully. They do by nature the things of the law. The work of the law is written in their hearts. This is what it means, what Paul means when he says, therefore themselves the law. Murray says, and again, he's got a number of wonderfully pithy assertions here of what the passage means. Murray says, the law of God confronts them and registers itself in their consciousness by reason of what they natively and constitutionally are. Good statement, huh? The relevance of this for apologetics should be evident. We never come to lawless men. We never come to men that don't have a clue about God and his law. We never meet any man like that. All of them are confronted with the law of God in their own consciousness by reason of what they natively and constitutionally are. The apostle teaches that men without special revelation still know the law of God. The existence of God's law does not need to be proved to them, just like the existence of God does not need to be proved to them. Rational argument and special revelation clarify, intensify, and remind them of the demands of God's law, but are not the basis for their original knowledge of it. And then, having seen the reality and means, we come to the identity of the law with which they are confronted. And this is a question that takes a little time to sort out. I think it's evident from verse 12a, and then we could assume from verse 12a, that it is the law of God which is the focus here, because they are said to sin and perish in light of what? Not some other, not some law or other, but clearly in light of the law of God. It's the law of God that brings wrath. It's the law of God that is the necessary precondition for sin and violation. It's the law of God that's the necessary precondition for the imputation of sin. It's not some other law. So we might assume that from the statement of the fact that they sin and perish. But here's what's important. In the Greek phrase, they are law to themselves, law does not have the article. It's indefinite, at least in its grammatical construction. Elsewhere in verses 14 and 15, law also occurs without the article. So we have to ask the question, what does Paul mean by law in the phrase, they are the law to themselves? Is it law in the abstract? Is it the law of God? Is it something else? What does he mean when he says they are law to themselves? Well, first I want you to get a good clear handle on the data, so let me lay it out here. There are five occurrences of law in verses 14 and 15, okay? In the Greek, three of those occurrences lack the article, but the New American Standard still translates two of the three occurrences that lack the article as if the article were present. Of course, when I say three lack the article, that means two of the occurrences of law in verses 14 and 15 have the article, right? Follow that? Well, maybe this will make it clearer. The first occurrence, who do not have the law. There's no article in the Greek. The New American Standard has the article in its translation, but the Greek says, who do not have law. And the second occurrence, also in verse 14, the article is present in the Greek. When Paul says, they do the things of the law, the article is present. Clear reference to the law of God, and in this context, to the law of God given to Israel, because that's what Romans 2 is talking about. Three, verse 14, there's the third occurrence there. There's no article in the Greek in the phrase, these not having law, but the New American Standard against translates with the article. Four, verse 14, there's no article in the Greek, and in this case, the exception, the lone exception of the New American Standard of the five, they do not translate it then with the article. They do not supply the article here as they do in the other two cases where it's lacking. They simply translate, are a law to themselves. And then the fifth occurrence is in verse 15. The article is present when he says, the work of the law, the work of the law is written in their hearts. Okay, you follow all of that? The data clear to you here? Five occurrences in the Greek, two have the article, three do not. But of the three that do not, two of the three, the New American Standard supplies it. Interesting, okay? You say, what in the world's going on here with translation? I don't think the New American Standard's odd here. I think you'll find something similar in most of the other standard English translations. So we say, what's going on here? Well, let me see if I can sort this out. The data makes clear three reasons why I think the article should be supplied in occurrences 1, 3, and 4, and that the reference must be understood to be the law of God. Okay? First, law without the article often refers to the law of God and is so translated And Romans 2:13, 25, 27, 7, 25, 13, 8, and 10. All of those are uses of the term law without the article, and in each case, the reference is to the law of God. So the absence of the article is no argument that it's not the law of God in view, that there's something going on here because Paul leaves the article out. Apparently, he expects us to supply it, and the English translations actually do supply it in those occurrences. Two, when Paul says in verse 14 in occurrences 1 and 3 that Gentiles do not have law, follow me here, he cannot mean that they were without law of any kind. Can he mean that? The Gentiles do not have law. Does that mean they're without law of any kind? Well, of course it doesn't mean that. The Greeks had laws. The Greek city-states had laws. The Romans had laws. In fact, they even thought their gods had laws. When Paul says they do not have the law, he's not saying they do not have law. He's not saying that they have no law of any kind. Of course not. He's saying they don't have the law of God. And conversely, when he says they are law to themselves, the article may be supplied. They had many laws, but were without the law of God specifically. And third, Paul says twice in occurrences 2, verse 14a, and 5, verse 15, that the law with which the Gentiles is confronted is the law of God given to Israel. The occurrence in verse 15a is important, the work of the law written in the heart. That's important because it alludes to the law written on stone in the Old Covenant. The law was written on stone in the Old Covenant, but Paul says, before all of that, in creation, the law, the work of the law was written on the hearts of men. And, of course, the writing of the law on stone finds its complement in the writing of the law of God on the heart in the New Covenant, Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34. So this shows, I think, the fundamental identity of the law of nature with the law of the Old Covenant and the law of the New Covenant. Fundamentally, the law of nature and the core of the law given to Israel and the core of the law to which Christians are bound through Christ, all of them are fundamentally identical. And Romans 2 is one of the classic passages on that subject. This is why many years ago, how long is it now? 30 years ago, when Baptist Reformation Review first began to publish the ideas that we know as New Covenant theology today, I wrote a 10-page letter to John Zenz and told him in that letter that Romans 2 did not support what he was saying, because Romans 2 teaches the fundamental identity of the law of God in all ages of the world in Romans 2, 12 to 15. We are not to distinguish, then, what law Jew and Gentile possessed. It is the same basic law, but in a different form and clarity. Okay? Fourth, how should occurrence 4, these to themselves are law, then, be translated? Given everything that we've seen, how should it be translated? Well, we must translate, I think, they are the law to themselves, or for themselves. The Dative can be translated to or for. First reason for this is that all the other occurrences in verses 14 and 15 clearly refer to God's law, as in fact most English translations see very clearly. Second, twice in these verses we must translate they are the law to themselves. Paul says Gentiles have the law of God. They are to themselves not some law or other, but the law of God. And they say, where does he do this twice? Well, in the phrase, they do the things of the law, and in the phrase, the work of the law is written in their hearts. This shows the extent, then, of their knowledge of God's law. It is not a mere vestige of moral law. It is not some law or other that they are imbued with by their nature and creation. It is the moral law of God itself. And then Paul comes, having given us the initial assertion, to its rational explanation. How can I say, Paul asks, it seems, that they are the law for themselves? Well, he says, for this reason, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts. Paul here shows why he is certain that Gentiles are the law to themselves. First of all, notice the subject of the clause, which in the Greek reads hoitinos. The pronoun has a causal force. Apparently this particular, it can sometimes have a causal force, as it does, in fact, in Romans 1:25. And so it can be translated, because such ones show that they, the work of the law written in the hearts. Because, in that, as the New American Standard says. So it should be translated, because such Gentiles show the work of the law written in their hearts. This states why Paul knows the Gentiles are the law for themselves. He knows this because they show, they manifest the work of the law written in their hearts. Notice the predicate of the clause, the verb show, endeknuntai, show. The verb refers to an external manifestation, a showing of an internal reality. I think that's pretty obvious. But I think it's an important distinction that we need to keep in mind. The internal reality is the work of the law written in their hearts. Who did that? God did that. Who wrote the work of the law in their hearts? God did. But who shows the work of the law written in their hearts? They do. So this distinction I'm making right here between the internal reality and the outward manifestation is pretty important, because one is the work of God and the other is the one is the work of man. What God does is perfect. What man does and shows, however, is not perfect. He exhibits the work of the law written in his heart, but as we're going to see, he doesn't exhibit it perfectly, or in fact, properly. They show this internal principle by the reality stated in verse 14a, they do the things of the law, and restated in verse 15b, their conscience bearing witness, so forth. The direct object, the work of the law written in their hearts. Now here's something you've got to understand here. Paul does not say that the law is written in their hearts. It says the work of the law written in their hearts. Yes, I know it says that. Paul does not say that the law is written in their hearts, but that the work of the law is written in their hearts. Now, just think about that. Why might that be important? Why might that distinction be important? Well, I want to point out something here. In the Greek, the word written agrees in case with work and not law. It is not law which is written, but work of law which is written. The word work and not the word law agrees with written. Okay? Paul avoids, again, ask yourself the question, why? Paul avoids saying Gentiles have the law written on their hearts. Why does he avoid saying that? Why does he so carefully say the work of the law is written on their hearts? Why? Well, because if he had said the law was written on their hearts, this would imply that they were saved and members of the new covenant, because this is the blessing of the new covenant, that the law is written on our hearts and put there by the grace of God. Jeremiah 31:31-34. So if he had said the law was written on their hearts unqualifiedly, this would have implied that they had a part in the new covenant and were saved. But of course, if he implied that, that would run counter to everything Paul intends to teach in this passage. He is teaching not that Gentiles without the law can be saved. He is actually teaching precisely the opposite, that they cannot be saved. So Gentiles are confronted with God's law. The work of the law is written in their hearts. And we're going to have to come back and ask what that actually means. This is something slightly different, in fact, emphatically different than having the law written in your heart. But Gentiles are confronted with God's law, yes, but it is not written, savingly, in their heart. So, second question, what then does Paul mean by the work of the law? I thought I knew what that meant once. And I had a discussion with colleagues of mine, and I changed my mind. Yes, you heard it here first. I changed my mind. There are two choices that the commentaries will give you. There is the view held by John Murray, and it was the view I held. I mean, John Murray said it. It must be right. this says that the work of the law is the work which the law requires of us. Okay, now follow that. Look at that closely. The work of the law is the work which the law requires of us. What the law requires is written in our hearts. Now, Murray says, things required and stipulated by the law are written upon the heart. Now, that's the first choice. I'll refrain from comment. But then there's the view held by exegetes like Theodore Beza and Robert Haldane, representing many others, okay? And this view asserts that the law's work, or the work of the law, is the work that the law does. It's not what the law requires that's written on their hearts. It's what the law does that is written on their hearts. See the difference? Not what the law requires, but what the law does. The law does a lot of things besides require things of us, according to the Bible. Now, as I said, having held Murray's view for some years, I now favor Haldane's and Beza's, and I'm sure it's the view of a number of others. The second view appears better to me now, for the following reasons. I think that what Paul is saying is that what the law does is written on the heart. First, the precise expression here, the work of the law, is found nowhere else in the Bible. Yes, the Bible speaks of the works, plural, of the law, and it speaks of the righteousness of the law, but there is no other occurrence of the phrase the work of the law. Okay? Now, it's because of the similar sounding phrases, the works of the law, that is to say the works the law requires, and the righteousness of the law, that is to say the righteousness the law requires, that most exegetists have almost without thought defaulted to the idea that the work of the law is what the law requires. But I don't think those are strict parallels, and I don't think they support the meaning, the work required by the law. Here's another thing. The general context of Romans 2, 1 to 16 favors Haldane's view. Paul is thinking in this context, remember, of the hypocritical tendency of mankind to pass judgment on others. Remember Romans 2, 1 to 3? Therefore, you have no excuse, every one of you who passes judgment, for in that which you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same things, and we know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice such things. But do you suppose this, O man, when you pass judgment on those who practice such things, and do the same yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? What were these hypocrites doing? Passing judgment on other people. Well, that's what the law does. It passes judgment on people. Look at the verses that follow with regard to the Jews. But if you bear the name Jew and rely upon the law and boast in God and know his will and approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of the immature, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and the truth. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that one shall not steal, do you steal? You who say that one should not commit adultery, do you? What's the law do? It says you shouldn't commit adultery. That's what the Jews were doing. And in their own way, that's what the Gentiles were doing. They were doing what the law does. You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, through your breaking the law, do you dishonor God? So I think in this context, Paul is thinking of the tendency of human beings to pass judgment on other people, to do exactly what the law does, which is pass judgment on other people, and yet to practice the very same things hypocritically. It's thus natural to see Paul saying that they show the work of the law, the work of the law which the law itself performs, by their passing judgment on and accusing others. This is what the law does. The law accuses people. The law passes judgment on people. The law, in fact, sometimes acquits people in an outward sense. So the general context favors Haldane's view. Third, I think, the things of the law must be a reference not to the things required by the law, but to the things done by the law. They do the things of the law by nature. They do by nature the things of the law. It is by doing the things of the law. Now notice this. I grant this is close reasoning here, but I think if you think carefully, you'll see it. It's by doing the things of the law that they are the law to themselves. Paul says they are the law to themselves, and how do I know that? He says because they do the things of the law. Now think about that. They are the law to themselves. How do I know that? Says Paul, because they do the things of the law. Now, if that means they do what the law requires, they are the law to themselves because they do what the law requires, which is Murray's view, right? This cannot mean that, it cannot mean that, because then Paul's logic would be something like this. They are the law to themselves because by obeying the law, they become the law. Well, that's the way Paul would be reasoning if Murray is right. And those who follow him are right. They are the law to themselves because by obeying the law, they become the law. Well, of course, everybody knows that's not what happens. We don't become the law by obeying the law. We can be the law by doing the things that the law does. So the idea that we are the law to ourselves because we do the things of the law, that is to say we do what the law requires, is nonsense. But if the phrase means that in doing the things performed by the law, what does the law do? It defines right and wrong. It commands. It condemns. They are the law. Then this makes sense. If by the things of the law and the work of the law, Paul refers to defining right and wrong, commanding, condemning, doing things like that, well, you can see how they are the law to themselves then. They are the law for themselves because they're doing exactly what the law is given to do. Now, I haven't put this fourth thing in here. At least I don't think I did. I'll wait to say it because there is a fourth thing. Fourth, the phrase, the work of the law written on their hearts, would logically demand that the promise of the new covenant has been fulfilled in the case of these Gentiles if it means that what the law requires is written in their hearts. Now, Murray doesn't want this conclusion. I know he doesn't want this conclusion, and nor do a lot of people that take this view. But what I'm saying is they logically get it whether they want it or not, okay? If the work of the law is the work which the law requires, so that what the law requires is written in the hearts, then how is that not the fulfillment of the promise of the new covenant? If what the law requires is written in our hearts, then then what the law requires is written at the seat of our convictions and affections. And that's the promise of the new covenant. So there is no real distinction here if you adopt Murray's view. You end up saying what you don't want to say, that the promise of the new covenant is fulfilled in these Gentiles because what the law requires is written in their hearts. Well, what the law requires is written in their hearts, and that's the new covenant promise. Okay? The promise of the new covenant is that God would write his law, what it requires, his precepts, on our hearts. That's what it is. Okay, well, you may have questions about that. So we come having answered the question, what are the things of the law? What are the work of the law? It's what the law does, defining right and wrong, being the embodiment of truth and knowledge, as Paul says there. We have to ask the question, and this is a really important question, what specific functions of the law does Paul have in mind? First, Paul is thinking of the condemning function of the law. Gentiles pass judgment upon and accuse one another, 2:1-3. Second, he's thinking how the law enables men to know God's will. That's prominent there in 2:17-19. If you bear the name Jew and rely upon the law and boast in God and know his will and approve the things that are essential, how does that happen? Being instructed out of the law. Right? So it's the law instructs us. It condemns us. It instructs us as to the requirements of God. The law gives men God's standard of right and wrong. And this is, in fact, one theme of Romans. If you check out the passages I have here, you see Paul is talking about this everywhere in Romans, that the law gives men God's standard of right and wrong. The law condemns men. This is what the law does. This is the work of the law. And it's everywhere in Romans. Now, since Paul is answering the objection about how Gentiles can sin without law, then I think this function of enabling men to know God's will is primary in Paul's mind in these verses, but it's not the only thing. The work of the law is what the law does. Commanding, condemning, informing, that's what the law does. And the primary purpose here in our text is, of course, instructing men in what God requires. So you come out the same place, but I think with a better and safer exegesis. Okay? External manifestation. The work of the law is written in the heart, and as such is invisible. Well, of course, to anybody but God, but invisible to us, so and invisible to Paul. So how does Paul know that the work of the law is written in the heart? Well, it's manifested visibly and continually by the behavior of fallen men. This is first stated in verse 14a, they do the things of the law, then restated in verse 15b, their conscience bearing witness and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. The doing of the things of the law, the conscience bearing witness, the thoughts accusing or even defending them, manifest the work of the law written in the heart. As manifestations of the work of the law, they are not the same as the work of the law. I need to go back and say it again. The work of the law written in the heart, that's what God did. The manifesting of it is what we do. And that's a pretty crucial distinction, okay? The work of the law is God's creation, but the doing of the things of the law is their depraved manifestation of it. Even the conscience, even though it manifests when it's active and vocal, even the conscience may be defiled, for Titus 1:15. And so all the manifestations of the work of the law written in heart are defiled and depraved, but the work of the law itself remains indelible upon the hearts of men. Suppressed in unrighteousness, and therefore its manifestations depraved and defiled, but still there. Now, look at verse 14a, particularly, where Paul says, they do by nature the things of the law. This is an interesting statement, especially when you examine it more closely. Paul says that these actions, this doing the things of the law, are instinctive. He uses the word nature. That is to say, they're done by the light of general revelation, by a general revelation that comes from within them and not just from without them. Their knowledge of the law of God is ineradicable. And not only are these actions instinctive, Paul says that they are repetitive. When the Greek word hoton, employed with the present subjective of the verb do, poieo, means whenever, as often as, every time. So Paul is saying, every time they do the things of the law, every time they do by nature the things of the law, these not having the law are the law for themselves. So you see, the actions are repetitive. They don't just do what the law says, and they don't just act like the law once, occasionally. They do it repetitively. They do it again and again and again. So Paul's not thinking of an isolated instance in which they do what the law does, but repeated occasions where Gentiles do what the law does. It happens all the time. And in fact, one of the great contradictions of a materialist and naturalist worldview is the fact that people are ineradicably moral. They can't stop themselves. The worst people, the most depraved people, can't stop themselves from thinking in terms of right and wrong. They still have ideas of right and wrong. They can't stop having ideas of right and wrong. It's part of being human to have ideas of right and wrong. And again, the repetitive nature of these actions is indicated as well in the present tenses of Romans 2, 1 to 3. And then this whole thing is restated in verse 15b, their conscience bearing witness and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. The conscience of the Gentiles shows or visibly manifests the work of the law written in their hearts. Lenski remarks that the grammatical construction of the phrase accusing or else even defending them implies that, well, accusation is more common. But occasionally, at least in an outward sense, they do what they know is right and their conscience defends them, even against false accusation. Well, that's what we would expect in light of Romans 2, 1 to 3 again. John Murray says, accusation, and here John Murray pulls out one of his unique words, excusation. I love John Murray. I'm not sure if this you could find that in any dictionary. Maybe it's there, but accusation and excusation, whether of ourselves or others, are activities which evidence moral consciousness and therefore point to our indestructible moral nature, the only rationale of which is the work of the law of God written in the heart. Okay? Concluding lessons. First, this passage confirms the teaching of Romans 1 as to the reality of the knowledge of the living God and those without special revelation. We saw this in Romans 1. Now we see it again in Romans 2. The work of the law is written in their hearts, and thus they confront themselves with both the precepts and the penalties of the law of God. They tell themselves what the law requires, and they tell themselves what their deeds deserve. And thus they know the one true and living God, because they know him specifically in his position as lawgiver. Furthermore, they know this God by nature. They know him by means of their own hearts. Thus, this knowledge must be absolutely universal among those who possess human nature. You can't say some people have it and some people don't. Some people know God, the people with more common grace. Some people know God and some people don't. No, this knowledge is absolutely universal among those who possess human nature. Can't say it's potential in some people, but actual in other people. No, you can't say that, because this knowledge is absolutely universal among those who possess human nature. Secondly, this passage brings to completion the teaching of Romans 1 concerning the source of their knowledge of God. In Romans 1, 19 and 20, the source of this knowledge is external creation. That's clearly what Paul has in mind when he refers to the things that are made from the world's creation on. Okay? In Romans 2, 15, the thought is added that man's own nature and heart reveal the knowledge of God. And thus Kuyper is right. Yes, this is Abraham Kuyper when he says that man has a twofold office in Revelation. Man is both the source and the recipient of revelation, because he reveals God and his law to himself. Kuyper says, if the cosmos is the theater of revelation, probably alluding to Kelvin there, in this theater, man is both actor and spectator. A third thing is this. This passage, of course, expands the teaching of Romans 1 as to the extent of their knowledge of God by nature and creation. How many do men know God? Of course, Paul has already emphasized that this knowledge of God is more extensive than we might realize when he uses the phrase, remember last week, not only his eternal power, but also his divine nature. But not only do men know God, but they have an extensive knowledge of the moral requirements of his law. They are the work of the law. They are the law to themselves in that they show the work of the law. Now, this might be deduced from the fact that men, according to Romans 1, 18 to 20, know the character of the living God. Since the moral law of God is simply the transcript or account of his character as it comes to bear upon or controls the regulation of human conduct, to know God truly is to know something of his law. You can't know God without knowing his law, because the law is the moral transcript of his character coming to bear upon us for the regulation of our conduct. But having said that, all this is confirmed by Romans 2:12a, 14, and 15. 1:32 also refers to the extensive list of sins in 1:29 to 31, saying, those who practice such things are worthy of death. Remember Romans 1:32? It's important not to forget it. It says, and although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. But here the key point is, they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things. What things? Well, the extensive list of sins that Paul has enumerated in verses 29 to 31. And what are they? Well, the such things of 1:32 include violations of the 10th commandment, greed, envy, the 9th commandment, deceit, gossips, slanders, the 8th commandment, greed and envy, the 6th commandment, malice, murder, strife, unmerciful, 5th commandment, disobedient to parents, and the first 4 commandments are kind of summarized in the words haters of God, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. A many-sided, here's the conclusion that we must come to, a many-sided revelation of God's law is planted in man by creation. Now, that concludes the lecture for this hour. And next hour, we're going to come on to look at Acts 17, all too briefly. But that's what our time allotment allows. Okay, we'll take questions now, both off the internet and from you here. So let me know if you have any questions. Okay. Oh, thank you. Okay, I'm going to try to go to your first one first, Paul. Paul asks, do you believe that at least a basic knowledge of this kind of guilt is necessary for salvation? A basic knowledge of this kind of guilt is necessary for salvation. I'm not sure what you mean. You may need to clarify this for me, Paul, and feel free to do that. But, you know, Jesus clearly taught, they that are whole need not a physician, but they who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. And so if your question implies that men have to have a sense of their guilt, they have to have an experience of their guilt in order to see their need of Christ and to come to Christ, I think that's certainly scriptural and clearly scriptural. And if that's what you mean, yes, my answer would be. But please clarify. And then he says, one more question. If people cannot keep from being moral, thinking in terms of right and wrong, is this a result of the fall? Was the fall in the will of God? Are people guilty within the, and I'm not sure if I'm losing something there, or are people guilty within the W something? I'm not sure what that means, but no, people being moral, I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question right, Paul, but people being moral is not a result of the fall. People thinking in terms of right and wrong. Right and wrong, a standard of right and wrong, commands dictating right and wrong were, of course, there before the fall, at least in the commandments regarding the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But, of course, with the advent of sin, I suppose in some respects the condemning of others and the telling of others that they're sinful, Romans 2:1-3, that didn't happen before the fall. So in some sense, this is a result of the fall. Was the fall in the will of God? I don't think we need to raise that question with regards to Romans 2, because being moral isn't a result of the fall, and even having a heart that informs us and says amen to God's commandments is not a result of the fall. And so I'd rather not take up the question here, Paul. If the fall was the will of God, that's a question that we will take up, however, when we get to God and his decree later in the semester. So just hold your fire there, and maybe we'll be able to address it more appropriately then. Okay, you have any questions? Any other questions, either live or in internet land? I'm going to go back and check out Paul's. Are people guilty within the will of God? Well, again, Paul, it still makes me want to say, let's wait till God and his decree before we answer that. Okay, it seems like that's all the questions, and we will take a break right now, and we'll begin just a minute or two after 8:30.